for great-looking t-shirts, hoodies, and sweatshirts, the TNT Shop is now open at tntradio.live. Perspective with Jesse Zurawell on today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
Welcome to Perspective. I'm Jesse Zurawell, your host for the hour. Joining me once again today is Glory Jones. Glory holds a degree in international relations and is an independent activist whose work focuses on advocacy for political prisoners, environmentalism, anti-imperialism, information freedom, and liberation from all forms of tyrannical systems. She co-hosts the Slow Newsday program, which you can find on Rockfin. Glory, welcome back. How are you?
Yeah, that's how I'm feeling, but it's good to be back on your show.
It's good to have you back. Let's start where we left off last time, or where we spent a lot of our discussion last time, in Florida. And we talked about a bill which was on the verge of possibly being signed into law that would place a heavy burden on people who were opposing development, real estate development, land development. And DeSantis signed it into law. Not much was reported on this anywhere. So can you give us some insight into what happened there?
Yeah, well, I mean, so essentially the deadline that he had was May 25th, which was last Wednesday. It was actually the 24th, my bad. He had until May 24th to sign this bill, which was SB 540, or what we kind of dubbed it, the sprawl bill, because it would basically, it basically has the potential to enable these sprawling developments all across Florida, whether it be a development that encroaches into the Everglades and further messes with that environment, or whether it's something like smart city development, which definitely, without a doubt, needs to be channeled going into the future, the further and further we get into Agenda 2030 and get close to that actual year. So just last Wednesday, rather than veto it or not sign it at all, which would have let it become a law to begin with, he signed it. But, you know, the only people that really reported on it were the same local activist groups that were tracking it to begin with. And also, it was really done without any, like, without any announcements from his office, from the governor website, or without any sort of special fanfare, like, oh, look at me, I'm in Israel signing this public nuisance bill, or, oh my God, we're doing such a big thing to sign this anti-woke bill, whatever that means. So there really wasn't much of a big deal from DeSantis's PR team, or from DeSantis's extended de facto PR team that exists in sort of the alt media sphere. There was really no coverage or no announcement or fanfare made about this, because it's really gone under the radar, despite how detrimental this bill actually is in terms of how it can hinder challenges to developers by forcing them to pay the legal costs of the prevailing party should they lose, knowing full well that many city councils are already in bed with a lot of these developers. So yeah, not too good.
I didn't realize last week when we spoke that DeSantis was in the process of, or had already, or was about to declare his presidential candidacy. So our timing was pretty spot on in that regard.
Yeah, but me neither, he is, honestly.
And he did it, or tried to do it, on Twitter of all places with Elon Musk, which on the surface seems very telling, but also seems like beneath the surface some sort of PSYOP, but then again, to me, everything, almost everything seems like a PSYOP nowadays.
I mean, so, I'm in the same boat as you there, especially now with everything regarding, like, especially now with social media as a whole and any, and like really any sort of activity that operates out of social media, especially large platforms like Twitter and Facebook or Fedbook. It just seems like the spaces as a whole just seem to be so captured already. So when I see something like, for instance, Tucker Carlson moving to Twitter live streams to give news, or for instance, what you just brought up, Ron DeSantis announcing via Twitter space his run for president. It's just like, okay, like we already get it. This whole space is already captured. You don't need to rub it in anymore. But unfortunately, people are always going to fall for that same PSYOP.
Yeah, it's been amazing to see how people have flocked back to Twitter. And I'm not knocking anybody who uses it. I used it for many years and I don't anymore. But I can see if you use it judiciously or try to, how it can be useful. But that said, it's been amazing to see how, especially after Elon Musk took over, in inverted commas, because I still am not clear what the dynamics actually are there. And I don't think anybody outside of his circle has a good idea of what the dynamics are. That said, since he quote unquote took over, it's been amazing to see how people have flocked back to it and have championed it as a freedom of speech platform, and also to see what a mess it's become in terms of wild speculations and proclamations, which, as somebody who's all in on free speech, go for it. And people should be smart enough to do their own research and make up their own minds. But the way that announcement of his takeover and his ostensible takeover catalyzed this swarm, I think is the best way to put it. And again, not to belittle or dehumanize anybody who's taken part in that, but it's like a swarm phenomenon that occurred and it's still occurring. And it's amazing too to see people engaging in Twitter spaces and these other forums perhaps that exist where people can get together and exchange information, which again, I'm all for, but it doesn't seem like many
people. You just have to be cognizant of what it actually is, you know? You have to, don't try and sell it as something that's different, you know? If you do pay money willingly to get a blue check, don't say that this is totally going to boost me. I'm getting this, blah, 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 so I can get a huge boost from the algorithm. Because realistically, a lot of people who bend over and get those blue checks still get ridiculously censored. It's just that now they can post longer videos and tweets with more characters. So realistically, you just have to be real about what it is. You know, it's a captured, controlled, flaming dumpster fire that's a cesspit of groupthink, you know?
Right. And that hive mind that it's become, in a sense, is being mined constantly, not just for personal data, but for emotion, for behavior, how people respond to certain stimuli, to certain announcements, and that's being used to build something. And what that something is, I can speculate on, but I can say with almost certainty that it's in service of the fourth industrial revolution, which you and I have talked about quite a bit. Mm-hmm. And it's not something that's going to be good. And if you're aware of that and are okay with that, or however you look at it, again, I'm not trying to fault anybody here, then okay. But if you're not, then I think it behooves you to do some research into what's actually going on. And this isn't to say that any social media platform, any other social media platform, is immune from this, or websites even, or forums. It's all being mined to some extent for, again, not just our personal data, but our personal data, our, again, emotions and behaviors. So it's something we need to participate in mindfully. And I don't see a lot of people doing that, but I'm also not on Twitter, so I don't have the the best finger on the pulse, or a finger on the pulse. I have one close to the pulse, I suppose you could say. But it's, all in all, it's a very interesting, and for me, a very disturbing phenomenon to watch.
Yeah, that's a good way to look at it. I mean, I do have a Twitter account. And yeah, I'm afraid I can just confirm everything you're saying. So yeah.
But again, it's not like I have no illusion about Telegram, which I'm on, not being mined, or
Fetagram,
these other platforms, Instagram, Facebook, Getter, Truth Social, the whole gamut. It's being mined for our personal data, as I put it before. That said, though, let's get into a bit more with Florida and a story that was reported last week, exactly a week ago, in CBS News, which you made me aware of. And that is that, quote, radioactive, unquote, roads made of potentially cancer-causing mining waste could be headed to Florida under new bill. And this headline sounds like tabloid fodder, but when you get into what's actually happening here, it's anything but. So what is the deal here?
So pretty much the reason why the term radioactive mining waste, or radioactive cancer causing mining waste, is even name dropped in that bill is because, in that headline, is because the bill that the article is discussing relates to a bill surrounding what's in Florida is called phosphogypsum and phosphogypsum sacks. So basically, phosphate mining is huge in the state of Florida, especially around the Tampa area, which is the west coast of Florida along the Gulf of Mexico. It's used mainly to produce fertilizers, of course, fertilizers that then go and contribute to the water pollution and wastewater pollution that we're unfortunately dealing with. So when phosphate is mined from the ground in Florida, what's left over is this material, is this like solid waste material called phosphogypsum, and they're arranged into stacks. And you can see them sometimes in the state of Florida, at least when you're near them, just because Florida is incredibly flat. So these are like some of the only hills that you'll come across in Florida. But what happens is they sit and they gradually stack up, and sometimes they collect water as well. And what can unfortunately happen, and what has happened in the past, is when one of these stacks breaks, or when there's an overflow of water due to some sort of storm, all that wastewater runs out of the gypsum stack and it then goes into the Gulf of Mexico, and it causes all kinds of toxic algal blooms and red tides and problems that have really been plaguing the Tampa area, especially in the past couple of years now. So that's kind of a little bit of background on the phosphogypsum stacks. And what the Florida Senate is trying to do with this bill is it's trying to authorize the Department of Transportation to use that material as a part of road construction, as a part of as a part of the transport system in the state of Florida. And I don't know what they're thinking behind it, is it honestly, other than, you know, we really don't have enough cancer causing waste material in the land, air and water right now. So let's just amp that up. But also, of course, the bill is sponsored by big fertilizer companies and big agribusiness. So that's one of the lobbying groups pushing for this bill to be passed. And like I said, it's just a whole clown show. And right now, the bill actually, the deadline for the bill to be signed isn't actually until next year in April 1st of 2024, because what has to happen before that is, I believe, the Department of Transportation here has to make like a formal recommendation to Governor DeSantis or DeSantBitch or Ron DeSantcook or whatever you want to call him. And they have to make a formal recommendation of, hey, you know, like we studied this a bit and determine whether it's actually a feasible idea and also whether it's within appropriate sort of EPA confines and EPA guidelines. So that's why we still have a little under a year before the bill can actually get signed, but it's on DeSantis's desk. So he can technically sign it at any point now, but we're still awaiting a study and a formal recommendation from the Department of Transportation. But unfortunately, in the near future, research is probably going to be done into determining whether we can use radioactive waste material as a part of our roads. And yeah, that's just a whole clown show, honestly.
It's very disconcerting. I was surprised to learn that Florida has, according to this CBS article, 27 phosphate mines. And the first thing that came to mind for me when thinking about why they would do this is they don't have enough places to put the byproduct, I suppose you could call it, of phosphogypsum. And that's the reason that's given. So we don't have enough storage capacity. Let's use it as, quote, road construction aggregate material, unquote. And then I started thinking, how does this fit into, or how might this possibly fit into the sustainable development goals? And if you look at sdgs.un.org/goals, there is number 9, industry, innovation, and infrastructure, and number 11, sustainable communities and cities. And those two in particular stuck out to me, especially number 9, industry, innovation, and infrastructure. And in short, the goal is to build resilient infrastructure, promote inclusive and sustainable industrialization, and foster innovation. So I could see this being spun as resilient infrastructure and innovative, because it's using what would be waste as nominally at least something useful, and also sustainable. It could be spun as sustainable because it's, I don't know what the carbon I don't know how carbon factors into phosphogypsum, but they could spin it somehow as being low carbon or carbon neutral, and therefore,
oh yeah, for sure,
largely fulfilling goal number 9 of the SDGs. And this too could be spun as fulfilling part or all of number 11, which has to do with sustainable cities and communities, and in short, that goal is to make cities and human settlements inclusive, safe, resilient, and sustainable. There's also 12, yeah, which is responsible consumption and production, ensure sustainable consumption and production patterns. So again, these goals are not intended to actually help the environment in any way.
100%.
They're behavior guidelines. Go ahead.
Sorry, go ahead. Oh yeah, I was just going to say, in general, the mining industry is something that's really culpable in terms of like actual damage to the environment and actual pollution to our air and water supply. But it's framed as this, you know, carbon neutral net zero endeavor, because it's something that's going to become a huge crux for a lot of technologies going forward that are required for the fourth industrial revolution, as well as the quote unquote green energy transition. So a lot of mining in general is going to be considered, you know, fit in within this framework as SDGs, deep sea mining included, and to actually bring something quick up as well regarding that, the ISA, International Seabed Authority, which is one of the main arbitrary bodies really pushing for that endeavor. They released a whole white paper outlining just how much they contribute to UN SDGs. So mining as a whole is something that fits within that SDG ESG framework, unfortunately. And it's really damaging to the overall environment and to nature and to people who actually sustain themselves on the land and, you know, all of us really. So you can kind of see the perfect storyline in that instance with that story with regards to gypsum stacks saying, oh, you have these gypsum stacks contributing to water pollution and red tides in the Tampa Bay area. And what we're going to do to help mitigate that is we're going to take that material and we're going to turn it into roads. Look at how innovative we are. Look at how carbon neutral this is. Look at how this fits within our effective ESGs, or wait, no, I'm sorry, we can't say ESGs because Ron DeSantis apparently divested from that. But, you know, it still fits within the appropriate SDGs and innovation rhetoric we want to usher in. It still fits within the whole these technological advancements that we try to promote in Florida via our innovation districts and through, you know, subsidizing a lot of tech bro movement here to South Florida, shout out Bitcoin 2023 in Miami. So it really fits within the appropriate framework of marketing that's kind of dropped on to the state of Florida.
Right. And to extrapolate out, I could see too how these roads, if they are built, if this goes forward and these roads are built, I could see how these phosphogypsum containing roads could be turned into impact investing opportunities. And if you bring in blockchain and tokens, how people could be incentivized to use these roads, because even though they're driving, that will be offset by the use of a carbon neutral road, let's say, and mm-hmm. you'll receive some sort of reward, some sort of social credit oriented reward for doing that in the fourth industrial revolution hellscape that the proverbial they are trying to build. So it's one of so many machinations that when you really burrow into it, you can see how it becomes an almost never-ending investment opportunity, especially in the space of so-called impact or social impact investing. But that doesn't do away with the fact that, as this CBS article points out, phosphate contains, quote, small amounts, unquote, of uranium and radium, the EPA says, and in the leftover waste, those elements decay to radium, which then becomes radon, a, quote, potentially cancer-causing radioactive gas, unquote, a spokesperson for the EPA told CBS News. There's much more in the way of radioactivity that's problematic with that. There's also a history of, as you alluded to, phosphogypsum storage going terribly wrong. And this article makes reference to an event that took place at, let me
Piney
find
Point,
it here.
By any chance?
Yes, Piney Point.
Yeah.
So what happened there?
Yeah, well, pretty much what happened was this facility is incredibly old. It's been operating for decades now. And what happened there at this facility known as Piney Point, which is, again, around the area of Tampa, specifically in Manatee County, which actually isn't even an active mining site anymore because of how old it is. It just contained a lot of those phosphogypsum stacks. What happened was there was a huge breach that happened in these stacks. And what ended up happening was millions and millions of gallons of wastewater had leaked out into, or not even leaked out, but poured and dumped out into the local waterways of Tampa. And it got dangerously close to reaching the supply of Tampa's and the larger area around Tampa's drinking water. Luckily it didn't, or so we're told at least, even though I kind of doubt that, honestly, it allegedly didn't reach Tampa's drinking water supply. But what it did happen was, to help mitigate the crisis, they essentially diverted all of this wastewater right out into the Tampa Bay. And what happened as a result, because of all the excess wastewater, which contains all kinds of phosphates and other forms of nutrient pollution, you have a massive algae bloom that takes place later that year. You have a massive red tide, which is basically a type of algae bloom, which contains this specific type of red-brown algae called Karenia brevis, and it's toxic to a lot of animals. So it produces not only like this reddish hue in the water, but it leads to a lot of fish kills as well, which definitely hurts local fisheries as well as tourism, and basically anybody who lives in the surrounding area having to deal with these massive fish kills. So that's just and that's just one of the effects as well. To this day, the Tampa Bay area is still dealing with a lot of problems with regards to wastewater pollution from phosphate mining, and the problems with algal blooms and red tides in Florida as a whole, not just Tampa Bay, are only getting worse and worse by the year, honestly, because of the presence of toxic algae, as well as again, red tides, nutrient pollution. And even now, we actually have a massive belt of sargassum, which is a type of seaweed that's headed our way. And while it can be harmless, it also has the potential to, when it floats up on your beaches en masse, it has the potential to irritate the lungs, because when it decays, it releases a type of gas that can be potentially like slightly toxic. So if you have asthma, don't plan on coming to Florida this summer.
Mm-hmm. When did the Piney Point disaster take place? What year was that?
2021.
Okay, so
it was
we're
one
talking
of many,
about
honestly,
2 years ago.
Yeah, it was one of many disasters that the area experienced, honestly. But I remember the big disaster that was referred to happened in 2021.
Mm-hmm. So there's that history, which does not bode well. There's also the fact that the EPA is being relied upon here heavily for its approval or disapproval. And I'll wager that there's going to be approval from the EPA for this eventually. Yeah. And if we want to, if we want a very recent example of the EPA's track record, then we don't need to look any further afield than East Palestine, Ohio, and how things have been going there since February. It's been hell on earth for the people of that town and surrounding areas. And that's largely because of how the EPA has been manipulating the situation and allowing Norfolk Southern to get away with murder, I don't think is an exaggeration. The last thing I want to point out about this phosphogypsum craziness in Florida before we throw it to a quick pause is that a paragraph in the CBS article reads as follows. If signed by DeSantis, phosphogypsum would join a list of other, quote, recyclable materials, unquote, in the bill that legislators say, quote, contribute to problems of declining space in landfills, unquote, and could be used for road construction. Other materials already approved include tire rubber, ash reside from coal combustion byproducts, mixed plastic, construction steel, and glass. So lots to parse there. The fact that ash reside from coal combustion byproducts, mixed plastic, construction steel, and glass are being used for road construction, at least according to this article, is crazy. But maybe I'm missing something there. But the big point being that phosphogypsum would join a list of other, quote, recyclable materials, unquote. And that fits into what we were talking about with the ESGs. So, sorry, not the ESGs, the SDGs. So it's an omission, a somewhat oblique one there by this article and by those who are pushing this plan that this is SDG oriented, but I don't think it's a stretch by any means to say that that is what is driving this or is in large part being used to justify this. That said, let's throw it to a quick pause, and I will be right back here on TNT Radio with Glory Jones after this.
TNT Radio's Mark Morano.
Mike Pence, I still don't understand how he gets 5% in the polls. Forget January 6th, forget election. Just stick with Mike Pence and what he did with COVID and public health. He wrote his recent book where he literally announced, it declared in the book, that he helped get masks across America to make sure Americans were masked for our safety with no hint of, oh, that may have been a mistake. He literally bragged about working, and that was working with 3M to get masks everywhere, to get those kids masked up, those kindergartners and toddlers. Let's mask them up for a few years. That ought to be good for their development, intellectual and speech habits. Then Mike Pence, in his book, his new autobiography, also wrote about how he bragged about how he got ventilators in hospitals, and every report coming out is how ventilators kill. It was one of the most ill-advised things. And that's fine if you thought he was doing something good at the time, but there's something called truth and accuracy. He should at least either ignore it now or admit it was a mistake. Not Mike Pence. Mike Pence also praised Fauci in the book. Mike Pence was at every vaccine and every lockdown press conference. Nary a word of complaint ever.
The Mark Morano Show on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Affordable housing. We can build that. Sustainable housing, we can build that. At MIT Modular, we understand the importance of housing for all and the importance of design, cost, and functionality. Our goal is to meet the needs of our growing population by converting shipping containers to livable units. If you're like-minded and in a position to invest in something meaningful and life-changing, we want to hear from you. We are a team of professional architects, engineers, and financial and tax experts dedicated to offering unique solutions that provide a brighter future. our Opportunity Zone Fund offers investors both real estate and operating business diversification, 5-year tax deferral on capital gains, annual tax benefits, and ultimately tax-free appreciation potential. There are Opportunity Zones all over America. If you're interested in learning more about our services, need affordable housing, or want to participate in creating a new vision for tomorrow, give us a call in the U.S. on 385-985-5702 or read more at mitmodular.com. MIT Modular. We can build that.
This is Jesse Zurawell and Perspective on today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
Welcome back to Perspective here on TNT Radio, where we are live 24/7. I'm Jesse Zurawell, and I am speaking with Glory Jones, independent activist and researcher and writer. I think it's fair to say, Glory, you've done your share of writing.
I have.
So we were talking about radioactive material in Florida with regard to phosphogypsum being used or potentially being used in road construction. To stay with the problem of radioactive material, let's look at what's going on with deep sea mining, which you referenced earlier, and some work that's come out recently pointing out the problems with radioactivity with regard to material that's mined from the deep seas. Can you talk about this?
Yeah, sure. So there's so many untold consequences that could come from a venture such as deep sea mining that day by day, there are more studies coming out that point to the detrimental impacts that could be happening. And day by day, I'm finding like even studies from, say, 5 years ago that show the detrimental impacts that deep sea mining could have on the environment. So in this one, what I found was alarming, to say the least. But basically, what was found was in testing. And just to go over this really quickly, when you mine the ocean floor, what people are seeking out is they're seeking out these potato-sized polymetallic nodules, which contain materials such as manganese, nickel, copper, cobalt, which is necessary for particularly electrical vehicle batteries, but also batteries that can power electric grids on your smart cities and other material necessary for the fourth industrial revolution. But with these polymetallic nodules, what one study actually found was that they could contain portions of radon gas upon taking out these nodules from the ocean and upon breaking them down. And they also found, I believe, thorium as well, alongside radium, in these polymetallic nodules. So if you're handling them, you could be potentially exposed to several times greater than whatever the safe amount, in quotes, put a big quotes around whatever the safe amount of radiation to handle is. But in handling these polymetallic nodules, you could potentially be handling several times the safe amount of radiation, and these pose substantial risks to the workers who would be involved on these ships, the workers who would be involved, for instance, with polymetallic nodules. You would need to have someone that's separating and cleaning these nodules, particularly making sure that you're separating these nodules from the organisms living on there, because a huge part of the organisms on the seabed do live in and around these polymetallic nodules. And it's a very unfortunate fact that a lot of these poor creatures would be sucked kilometers up to the surface. So you would probably need, assuming deep sea mining were to go through, which, you know, I pray it doesn't, even though the situation looks bleak now, you would need someone or something to separate these nodules from whatever collection of sediment or or bacteria or little creatures has accumulated along those nodules. So in handling that, you could come in contact with a disturbing amount of radiation. And that's just only one study on that as well. I'm trying to see if there's more studies on that because, you know, I'm not a scientist myself and I can't get my own grant. So I'm trying to see if there's other studies, but yeah, hopefully we won't need another study on this to come up to show the detrimental impacts of something like deep sea mining, because we know it would have terrible impacts not only on the ocean ecosystem, but on people who depend on the ocean ecosystem. And this just adds another layer of dangers to deep sea plunder, because then it would also put enormous health risks in for people who are actually working along on these deep sea mining vessels and really having to handle these nodules. So, yeah.
You turned my attention to an article at cosmosmagazine.com, not Cosmo, but Cosmos. And and it points out that the new research to which we're referring shows that nodules are efficient at picking up uranium radioisotopes, unstable forms of uranium, which emit high levels of alpha radiation as they decay. Among the radioactive sources are, as you pointed out, thorium-230, radium-226, and proactinium-231. And this research was published in Scientific Reports, a journal, and shows the activity of these nodules to be up to 1,000 times greater than current safety limits, again, with the caveat on safety limits there, because is there any safe amount of radiation? The article goes on to say the researchers suggest that inhalation, and these are researchers based in Germany, the researchers suggest that inhalation or ingestion of nodule fines, as they're known, radon gas, which was also detected in the form of radon-222, and exposure to certain high concentrations of radioactive substances during nodule processing pose substantial risks to human health. But as you pointed out, it's not just the health of the workers, which is bad enough, but the health of the people who rely on the sea for their food, for subsistence, in terms of fishing and selling those catches, and also in terms of the ecosystems in which these nodules reside. And they don't just show up there. They take a long, long time to develop, and they accumulate in their development, they accumulate these radioactive substances as part of the accumulation process. And what will this do to the largely unexplored and unknown ecosystem of the deep seas? There's been some recent work that's come out with regard to thousands of different types of species, and if not species, then creatures that are almost certainly going to be affected by this radiation and much other disruption that comes along with deep sea mining. Can you talk about that?
Yeah. Well, I mean, first thing I'll say is, unlike the unfortunate workers that would potentially have to deal with these radioactive materials, I assume that a lot of these deep sea dwellers are more resistant to this radiation, which again goes to show that they're meant to be down there and humans and our machines aren't. So, but tangent aside, what came out a couple days ago was this study, and it's in and it was actually like publicized too, so it's not hidden behind all those bullshit research paywalls. But it was published in Current Biology, and it basically shows that there are over 5,000 actually unnamed, or you could say undiscovered in quotes, species that were already, I don't know if a discovered is the right word, but they were already seen in the bottom of the ocean in these seabed environments. Because pretty much what happened was this study didn't actually go down into an area in, say, the Clarion-Clipperton or along the Mid-Atlantic Ridge or at the bottom of the Mariana Trench or any of that. It didn't necessarily do anything new in terms of field work. What it did was it took together the most prominent databases that had collected photographic and material and actual samples of organisms on the deep sea floor. And it brought that all together and it synthesized it. And it found that a large majority of the data collected on organisms at the deep sea is completely new and never seen before to scientists, and never, you know, quote unquote classified. And I'm not even saying that it needs to be classified. I'm not even saying that there needs to be a great endeavor taken to go and try and classify these organisms and collect more samples, especially because in our first episode on deep sea mining, when you rush exploration, then you open up the potential for scientists or groups that don't have the same amount of funding to use trawl nets to collect all their sample, which are incredibly detrimental to the deep sea floor. So I'm in no way, shape, or form aggregating for everybody to go gung-ho and try and discover these species themselves. And I'm sure no one thinks we are either, but I did want to point that out. But what the study did do was it found that in collecting and in aggregating all the information from these databases, it found that there's so many species on the seabed, on the seafloor, that are unknown, even though they were photographed in these databases, even though they were encountered. There wasn't any sort of effort to classify them, which again isn't necessarily a bad thing, but it can ultimately go to serve the agenda of people who try and downplay the importance of just what is at the seabed. Because that's what's huge about this study to me, is that it essentially found that there's, I mean, untapped troves of not untapped. I don't want to say untapped because that implies that we should tap them, but no, that there's all kinds of troves of biodiversity along the seabed that we didn't even know about before. And this was just collected from just a portion. So it can even be extrapolated to other areas of specifically the Clarion-Clipperton zone, but also the seabed at large, even what's thought to be these barren abyssal plains. And one thing else this study discovered, which I thought was incredibly important as well, was so the study actually it brought together much more than 5,000 species. It brought together about 6,000 to 8,000 species, but a large majority of them were unnamed and new to scientists. So of the species that were already named and sort of quote unquote known to scientists, 14% of them live directly in the polymetallic nodules and in the substrate. And of the unnamed ones, 13% of them also live in the polymetallic nodules. So that's about, 27% of the overall species here that live in these nodules and rely on them for shelter, for sustenance, because that just outlines this, the species that live in the nodules. That doesn't even count the people, the species that are suspended directly above the nodules that act like filter feeding organisms, which I actually found a study from 2019, which found that in an environment where they sort of carried out like a mini simulation of the effects of deep sea mining and then went back to it years later, they found that these suspension feeders were all but absent. So that's just one thing from the study that I wanted to point out. But I mean, it just goes to show, the whole thing goes to show how there's just so much at, that there's so much at stake if we are to undergo this venture. And it also goes to show just exactly how much people are also trying to downplay and obfuscate what's actually living at the seabed as a means to help usher in this deep sea mining agenda. And this is a tale as old as time too. You know, we see the playbook at large with Palestine and its illegal Zionist occupation, where you see people going, oh no, it's just desert there. So, you know, for Israelis to come in, we're going to innovate the desert.
That have been conquered by colonists, by Zionist colonists. Where can the latest study be found?
It can be found on Current Biology. That's the name of the magazine that it was released at. And luckily, it's open to the public. So, yeah.
I want to add to what you said about the largely unknown ecosystem and its components in the deep seas, and say that what is down there is down there for a reason and doing its thing for a reason that is not guided by or in service of us up here. And we don't even know what so many of these species are, let alone how they serve and are served by the ecosystem or ecosystems they dwell in the deep seas. So it's, without exaggeration, insane for us to go down there and start messing around with this without knowing quite literally anything about what we're messing around with and what the functions of it are and what balances what. And of course, this goes back to the fact that this deep sea mining is in service of the fourth industrial revolution. And
absolutely,
that doesn't really care about, it doesn't care about the environment at all. That's a pretense at best that it uses to sell itself. But then it also, if it does create a disaster, which I think is inevitable if this really goes forward, then that's a new disaster that can be capitalized upon by the so-called fourth industrial revolution, and another problem that needs to be fixed. It's the problem reaction solution dialectic, which I suppose you could say is almost as old as time, although it goes back to Hegel's time, so it's not terribly old. But
yeah,
again, like with the roads in Florida, it creates endless opportunities in terms of investments, in terms of making money, in terms of making capital, that are predicated upon disaster, but sold to us as mitigating disaster. We have about a minute left, so I'd just like to give you that minute for any final words you'd like to share.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Well, I mean, and just to add to your point as well, deep sea ecosystems are incredibly important in terms of helping to regulate sediment distribution along the in the ocean as a whole, as well as helping with temperature regulation, because that's where a lot of the cool water comes from. It comes from it comes from deeper in the ocean, and it comes up and it contributes to all kinds of influxes of nutrients that are healthy for the ocean. So if you mess with these deep sea ecosystems, you could also mess with a lot of like the ocean's natural regulatory systems. And that there are a lot of people that recognize that and are willing and are ready to fight that and have been fighting that for almost decades now, actually. And even if you, you know, say on the off chance you don't resonate with that, again, you just have to remember what this agenda is in service of. This is effectively forming the supply chain for smart cities, for quote, for, you know, quote, green technology, for surveillance infrastructure, for this global surveillance state that they're trying to usher into us. So if you want to stop that, this is one of the ways you can do that, by opposing it on the supply side, by opposing deep sea mining, not just, you know, for the environment, but also because if we don't oppose it, it will come back to haunt us. So, yeah.
Absolutely. Very well said. Glory, thank you again for your time and your insight. It's always a pleasure, even though we delve into some unpleasant things, but necessarily so. Thank you again.
Of course. Thanks for having me again.
And that's it for me for today. I will be back at the same time tomorrow. Stay tuned for Joe Hoft up next here on TNT Radio. Take care.